Welcome to The Cinematologist. I'm Neil Fox, and with me as ever is Dario Linares. Hello, Dario.
Hello, Neil. God, it feels like ages since we've spoken. It's really good to be back on the airwaves, but we're not on airwaves, back in the ether, whatever you want to call it, back on the internet, and discussing movies again with you. It seems, seems like months, really.
It does. It does feel like a long time since we touched base and had a chat, and those keen-eyed listeners will remember that we did say that we were going to have an episode just around the kind of Christmas festive period that sort of dealt with our films of the year, but life got in the way.
Yeah, basically flu got in the way for me. I mean, it was a pretty horrendous Christmas, 2 weeks of, you know, sheer hell, and I'm certain it was one of these new strains of flu that they were talking about going around, really, really bad. And I was abroad as well, so it didn't hit me in the best at the best time at all. And it actually sort of took me a couple of weeks to kind of recover my motivation to do anything afterwards, because I felt really low after coming into Christmas, looking forward to a break, and it just being kind of completely decimated. I just went through one of those periods of, I can't be asked doing anything, what's the point? So had to get out of that first. But happily now I'm more motivated to talk about movies and over the illness.
Yeah, I think that we were due a break, and I think it was important that we kind of took one after you were so cruelly robbed of your assigned break from academia over the Christmas period. So it's really good to be back, and we won't be dwelling too much on the past, because we are gearing up for a new season, lots of good films and events kind of in the pipeline. And this was sort of a happenstance, an opportune episode that we sort of came up with when we saw that just as we were coming back, the new film from Paul Thomas Anderson was coming out. And we've long talked about doing an episode about Anderson. We did record a kind of live response to Inherent Vice when that came out, but that's never aired. So this is our opportunity, really, to just kind of ease back into things with a chat about this American filmmaker and his latest work.
Yeah, and as you say, we really wanted to talk about Paul Thomas Anderson for a long time. We're going to try and make sure that this episode just doesn't fall over into a gush fest over how great we think he is. We'll try and put some parameters in place and some sort of devil's advocate questions to stop that from happening. But interestingly, we in our one of our previous episodes, our Ask Us Anything episode, one of the questions that came up was, what filmmakers do we think are going to continue the legacy of kind of, you know, canonical filmmakers that we've always revered, and, you know, like Scorsese or Coppola, or these sort of behemoth names. And again, we're totally aware of the of qualifying that in terms of the problematic nature of, you know, masculine directors and all that kind of thing. But having said all of that, I think that Paul Thomas Anderson is somebody who's already at that status. He's at that level. His body of work, his approach to cinema in the way that he seems to be speaking to American cinema as a body of work through his films, and also not just American cinema, but influences from European art house and from international cinema. His films do seem to have a sense of place within that history, and the themes and the narratives and the kind of grandeur and the complexity and the depth of what he's doing in cinema is second to none. I mean, I just don't see anyone. Well, maybe that's wrong. I mean, I think he is at the forefront of American cinema, particularly in this age where the constant discourse, the constant kind of lament is that American cinema is not what it was. He definitely is. If he's not the exception to that rule, he's showing that American cinema in that grand sweep is still there.
Yeah. It's often said that he's kind of, you know, well, in the early days, a derivative kind of 70s filmmaker, and that he would be very much at home in that era. But I think that what his body of work continues to prove is that he's kind of a necessary filmmaker for now, as someone who can draw on that entire history rather than be in the middle of it, to actually kind of have a dialogue with the past. And that period of 70s film is obviously so key to his early work and Inherent Vice. But the whole of cinema that's come before is something that we're very grateful for, I think, for as audiences now, to have him in our midst, you know, responding to that stuff. In terms of the, you know, is he the best? You know, like, where does he sit? What I always think of when I watch his work is, like, watching his work almost obliterates other American filmmakers. You know, just, I think you can watch a lot of filmmakers and think, okay, how does this fit with everything else? But for me, his work just, it just kind of just sweeps everything aside. It's like, it's so grand but intimate. It's so daring but kind of formally rigorous. It's so, you know, it's funny, and his kind of interpretation of genre is just seems utterly unique, that it just becomes kind of irrelevant in the same way that it does when we talk about canonical filmmakers to compare. You know, we don't really compare Coppola and Scorsese's films, but they sit side by side because they were contemporaries in that era, you know, and we talk about the differences, but it's not really like who's better. It's more just a kind of an aesthetic appreciation. And I think that it is the one thing that's, you know, that is a shame is that he doesn't really have anybody else who's kind of operating on that level, or in American cinema, who has evolved in the same way. I just think I look at that evolution, and the thing about Phantom Thread, which was one of the amazing things about it, was just how you realized, you know, that to say that he's a great American filmmaker is kind of narrow even now, because, like you say, those European filmmakers, particularly those kind of emigre filmmakers, but also British filmmakers that he clearly responding to. And it was just like, yeah, a kind of eye-opening. And I don't know how many other directors are that eye-opening 7 films in 20 years. Do you know what I mean? It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, just to make a couple of comparisons, and I know you wanted to sort of talk a little bit about the notion of kind of maturity, and maybe the comparison with Tarantino is something that you can talk about. But what's interesting is that just comparing him with somebody of who status-wise you could, somebody like Steven Spielberg, for example, and somebody who has gone through a transition, you know, and a, you know, if you want to say maturity, or there's been a development of the kind of themes and style and narrative styles and aesthetic styles that he's interested in. And I recently watched Bridge of Spies, and I've seen Lincoln, and, you know, one or two other. I mean, Bridge of Spies, I really struggled with. I just thought it was boring. And I haven't seen The Post yet. And I know that The Post is, you know, it's Steven Spielberg and it's got Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks in it. So it's kind of Oscar bait par excellence. But I've seen a couple of clips of it. And honestly, it just looks so mannered and inauthentic after watching Phantom Thread, which, even though that, you know, and we can talk about Daniel Day-Lewis, and there is a sort of, there is a school of thought that looks to an actor like that and says it's just kind of like pure technique, and you can end up just watching the technique rather than engaging, you know, on a sort of emotional level with the character, if that makes sense. But I just think that it's like you say, he sort of sweeps it all, or he sweeps Spielberg completely away, I think, for me, which is kind of incredible. And you sort of compare the performances of Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln and in Phantom Thread, and I don't know what it is. There is still something that remains the same, but there is more of a way in which Paul Thomas Anderson seems to be setting up the possibility of his actors to be able to produce something that is so grand, but also so subtle at the same time. I mean, it reminded me a lot more of something like Carol, in a way, you know, Todd Haynes, and also A Single Man. It reminded me a lot of that Phantom Thread. But I will come back to Phantom Thread a little bit later on. But yeah, I think I'm a huge, huge fan of Magnolia, and I know that I mean, that's still my favourite film of his. But you can see that the maturity that he's gone through when doing The Master and doing Inherent Vice and now Phantom Thread. He's a different filmmaker from back in those days. And that, I think there's a sense of confidence where he doesn't have to do that showy, throw everything editorially and camera-wise and narrative intricacies and, you know, this massive ensemble cast, which Magnolia and Boogie Nights, you could see they're of a particular way of thinking about cinema in terms of aesthetics, whereas now there's a level of kind of confidence in Phantom Thread and The Master and Inherent Vice that you can see that he's reached over time. And And again, you know, just coming back to you, it is totally different from somebody like Tarantino.
Yeah, I think the Tarantino thing was interesting, obviously, because he's in the news this week for just, you know, some terrible revelations about the way he treated Uma Thurman on the set of Kill Bill. So it kind of made me think about that kind of trajectory. Both of them were kind of labeled as the kind of, you know, or two of the great American hopes for cinema. And, you know, the accusation against Anderson was his young movie brat, you know, arrogant. And the way he wielded the story, you know, the camera in Boogie Nights, and then, you know, that kind of that sprawling story of, was, you know, sub 30 when he made that film.
Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a line to you from an opera. I want you to give me that line back in the language in which the opera was originally written. And for a bonus $250, you can sing it.
I'm Stanley Spector.
There is the story of a boy genius.
Willa Cather, Thomas Kidd, Jean-Baptiste Boclamoyer.
And the game show host.
I'm Jimmy Gator.
Live from Burbank, California.
First question for $25. This French playwright and actor joined the Béjart troupe of actors.
And the ex-boy genius.
I'm Chris Kidd-Donnie Smith.
I used to be smart, now I'm just stupid.
There is the story of the dying man.
I'm Earl Partridge.
I have a son, you know.
You do?
Find him.
I'm Frank T.J. Mackey.
His lost son.
What did he say? Because I am not going to take care of him. What does he want?
And the dying man's wife.
I'm Linda Partridge.
I took care of him through this, Alan. What now, then?
Me and him. Do you understand? There's right. No one else. No one else.
The caretaker.
Hello.
I'm Phil Parma.
See, this is the scene of the movie where you helped me out.
And there is the story of a mother.
I'm Rose Gator.
You come home soon after the show. I love you.
Love you, too.
And the daughter.
I'm Claudia Wilson Gator.
Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again?
And the police officer in love.
I'm Officer Jim Curring.
My life is very stressful, and I'd hope to have a relationship that is very calm and undemanding and loving. So if you are this person, please leave me a message at box number 82.
And this will all make sense in the end.
Just kind of, you know, just almost his identity as a filmmaker was kind of set in stone, you know, and he was kind of labeled all these things. And what's been so fascinating is his resistance to that, but his, like you say, his confidence that he is as good as people say, but he's not going to let it go to his head. You know, he's always going to try and reinvent or evolve as a filmmaker and push what he's capable of. And what I think is really underappreciated, particularly since kind of Punch Drunk Love, is the humanity. And, you know, it's a very dark humanity in There Will Be Blood and The Master, but it is a humanity that he's interested in, you know, in masculinity, yes, but also in, you know, the relationships between people as adults, you know, and his films seem to get, you know, progressively more adult as he gets progressively more adult. And I think that's amazing without losing their sense of kind of formal wonder. And when you look at Tarantino, whose work for me has become sporadically interesting and, you know, just kind of seen out of a sense of duty to the conversation a lot of the time rather than a real excitement, he is someone who absolutely seems to have believed his own hype. And when given free rein, and Anderson hasn't really had that same free rein, I don't think, you know, critically or, you know, sort of financially. His conversations about Phantom Thread showed that a lot of those decisions he made were, you know, were budgetary. He didn't have that kind of license to go off to the wilds of the mountains and shoot on 70 mil for 2 years or whatever. And the Tarantino seems to have just kind of got bloated and stayed arrogant and not as interested in kind of developing a more in-depth filmmaking body of work. But that's that, you know, that. But also what I think is, you sort of touched on there in terms of Day-Lewis and the other people, is that he's always been rooted in performance, you know, and that what he's doing as a filmmaker is in response to the performances. And I think that all of his films have these incredible performances from these, you know, and many of the actors of the last 20, 30 years who we think of as great actors, we think of through the lens of the roles that they've taken in Paul Thomas Anderson's films, be that Philip Seymour Hoffman, William H. Macy, Philip Baker Hall, John C. Reilly, you know, Julianne Moore. When we think of their great roles, we think of his films in the way that, you know, studio directors, you know, we think of certain studio directors like Ford or Hawks or Billy Wilder. You know, we associate those great performances with certain directors, and he is absolutely, but he is everything. Well, you know, again, without being too gushy, he is both a kind of great technical filmmaker, but also an actor's dream, you know, and there's not many filmmakers who can merge the two where it can be such a deep emotional connection with actors, and also this dizzying, just delightful cinematic experience. I think it's, that seems rare, even now, that seems quite rare.
I mean, it's interesting, just picking up, going back to the sort of Tarantino thing. I think Tarantino still just hasn't got out of making comic book films. I mean, like, just going back, Jackie Brown seems still to be his most mature piece of work. And that's a great film, and an underrated film, perhaps, if you can have a Tarantino film that's underrated. But you just can't see a Tarantino movie that would get an actor nominated for an award. You know what I mean? That has happened, but it's that sense of allowing the sort of context to be mature enough, kind of precise and almost like a canvas that you can recognize, but allows the actor to play on it. You know what I mean? I'm mixing metaphors there, but.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it is that, because he does get his actors nominated quite a lot, but it always seems to be for, you know, the surprise element of a DiCaprio in Django Unchained, or a Christoph, you know, the emergence of Christoph Waltz. But it's actors in the kind of role you wouldn't necessarily see them. And they are very good in those roles, and he's very astute at that. But you look at Anderson, and he's giving actors the kind of roles that they say aren't there anymore. You know, like those old Hollywood melodramatic or post-method ability to just go really, really deep. And I think that's what's interesting about for Lincoln. You know, Day-Lewis goes deep, but everybody else around him, you're just watching. Everyone's watching Daniel Day-Lewis be Lincoln. Yeah. You know, that's how it felt. Whereas in There'll Be Blood and The Master, you know, that everybody is bringing it. You know, like Amy Adams, particularly in The Master, you know, is not daunted by this kind of alpha male silverback battle between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix. She's going in there and giving the good she gets.
And this is where we are at. At the lowest level. To have to explain ourselves. For what? For what we do, we have to grovel. The only way to defend ourselves is to attack. If we don't do that, we will lose every battle that we are engaged in. We will never dominate our environment the way we should unless we attack. And the city's just noise. I know the city. I know its rotten secrets and its filthy lies and secrets. They invited us here and welcomed us, only to throw us down and kick us out. Grim joke.
That's what excites me is, like, you know, they say, oh, you can't, these films don't exist anymore. It's like, no, they do. They might just not look like they used to, because he's doing something formally, which is, but those performances are right there.
We can move into Phantom Thread and talk about that, because obviously the performances are key. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned There Will Be Blood. I don't know whether I felt that Dano, I think he was trying to sort of out Day-Lewis and didn't quite do it. Do you know what I mean? But here, I think this is what's so good about this casting and about the female leads in Phantom Thread. It's a fascinating film about power relationships, isn't it? And I think that the female leads almost do this thing in the character, but also in the acting, where they recognize what Day-Lewis is kind of doing, and they take it and kind of push it in the right directions. Do you know what I mean? They kind of react to it, and in a way that shows that their power. And there's certain moments in Phantom Thread where they just come straight back at him. But it's not, they're not trying to do it in this, it's almost kind of like out doing it through reserved, clipped, precise sentencing and holding themselves very still. Whereas Day-Lewis is doing this sort of, you know, embodying a certain type of persona with his face and with his glasses and with his hair. I mean, he uses glasses like a sword or something. He's doing this thing where his face is like Mount Rushmore, but it's also just so subtly moving. You know, it could almost be kind of like a CGI Anthony Serkis thing where the little muscles are moving at different points. It's absolutely, absolutely brilliant. But Yeah, so maybe, I don't know, maybe we should move into Phantom Thread. I nearly said Phantom Menace then. Can you imagine? Phantom Thread.
Yeah, well, my wife kept saying, is that the new Star Wars? I'm going to see Phantom Thread. Yeah, I mean, you know, I did tweet sort of, you know, that I am biased. I think, you know, my love for Paul Thomas Anderson kind of, it does know no bounds. Because I think what, you know, I was trying to think why, because obviously, you know, when Hard Eight and Boogie Nights came out, it was so exciting, you know, for someone who was really into kind of that American cinema of the 70s at that time, you know, sort of college and then university, like this, you know, being excited by that stuff, like both of us were, to kind of be greeted with a filmmaker who clearly loved that stuff and was just, as you know, almost as excited as we were about it and kind of telling these stories that didn't feel derivative, but obviously felt really inspired by. And then as I've kind of, you know, grown up, grown older, and my tastes have changed and evolved and developed, he, you know, so many filmmakers of that era when I was younger, I've kind of left behind because they don't seem to grow up. You know, they seem to mine the same territory. And he seems to have grown up as well with his films, and they've evolved and they've become more intricate and intimate and sophisticated. And, you know, that's been so exciting. And I know you were, you know, not trying to go in without kind of having a preformed opinion, as was I. And to be honest with you, just thinking that you're like seeing the trailer and thinking, he's such an American filmmaker. How's it going to work in London with this story about a fashion designer? You know, part of me was like, is this it? You know, is this the moment where he's just... but yeah, should not have doubted that, because I think, you know...
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing is, there have been... I don't want to say mixed reviews, but people who we know in real life, but also on social media, who we talk to about films, you know, there's been a split opinion. You know, there's people like, this is really boring. You know what I mean? We didn't like it. Essentially, that's what they're saying. And I went in, as you say, I was sort of, I've moved house recently. I've moved to London, and obviously the beginning of term has started. And I sort of went in slightly preoccupied in a way. I knew I was going to go and see it, but I wasn't in the headspace to kind of be zoned in going in. Do you know what I mean? Like, right, I'm ready for this. I just went in and said, okay, I'm going to watch it and then we'll talk about it afterwards. But having said that, you're right. I was like, I don't want to go in like, this is Paul Thomas Anderson, I love it, before we start. Because I think it's, you have to be real. I mean, it's difficult not to do that with filmmakers you already admire, but I was determined to try and not do that. So I was thinking, actually, I'm in the conditions here where I could just turn around and say, oh God, yeah, that was really kind of slow and boring. But boy, did it, you know, very, very quickly, I was completely in sync with what was going on. And I think that this charge of it being, you know, either slow or laborious, you know, and again, those who've criticized it could say boring. I think that if that's your reaction, then you're kind of not watching the film, to me. You know, or not taking into account what the film is trying to do. It's not, and this is what Paul Thomas Anderson does so well. He is in between a sort of narrative, non-narrative type of filmmaking. You know what I mean? There isn't a cause-effect. Part A follows into part B, and then you get the payoff in part C. It doesn't kind of work that way. And throughout, there were moments when I was watching it, and I was like, okay, I get it. Yeah, I get what this is. It's the, you know, the genius artist who's on the flip side of madness, and he's got his muse. And, you know, you could almost kind of say it's cliched storytelling moments in it, in that sense. And is all of this genius a kind of psychological effect of his sort of barely internalized need to kind of satisfy, gain comfort from, gain affirmation from his mother and all that kind of stuff. But every time I sort of thought, I get this, I know what it is, then something else is happening. And I actually feel like it is a film I need to see again, because I just don't think I've got enough of it and it hasn't settled. But there's so much in it on that first viewing that I really, really loved, that it is a film I want to go back and become more immersed in what passed me by in a way. And there is so much in it, again, that is speaking to cinema. I want to kind of look for those influences a lot more than I got in the first time, because I was just so sort of mesmerized by the acting in the first viewing in a way.
Yeah, as soon as it finished, I was like, yeah, I need to, I want to see that again. I need to see that again. You know, because it just felt rich as I was watching. I was like, but I had a very similar experience with The Master and Inherent Vice, which have, you know, increasingly split kind of critics and audiences. You know, and both of those made me want to see them again. And I've, you know, seen The Master a few times, and I've seen Inherent Vice about 8 times now. And they're just great films to live in. And I think this is another one that you could just live in this film because it's so rich with nuance and depth. And always, yeah, pulling the rug out from under you. And, to go back to what you were saying about the kind of, the performance from Daniel Day-Lewis, the whole film is that cliche of, you know, the acting is reacting. The three of them are constantly pushing and pulling against each other. And Day-Lewis, I've never seen him as giving with other actors, you know, where he's almost putting out, and it is funny, you know, this, I'm a petulant man-child genius. And you can see him having fun with it, but he's pushing it and almost kind of goading, like, what have you got, you know? And Vicky Creeps and Leslie Manville have got more than enough. And it is that, you know, people sort of said like 40s screwball kind of, and it feels like, yeah, you could go at that all day and it's going to be so rewarding, but it's not static.
Cyril is right. Cyril is always right. It's not because the fabric's adored by the clients that Cyril is right. It's right because it's right. Because it's beautiful. Maybe one day you'll change your taste, Alma.
Maybe not.
Maybe you have no taste.
Maybe I like my own taste.
Yes, just enough to get you into trouble.
Perhaps I'm looking for trouble.
Stop.
As the relationships grow, the film changes and moves into different directions. It's not just kind of smugly kind of having these great quips and lines, and some of the lines are absolutely magnificent. But it's interesting in taking the story somewhere, yeah, that you're not expecting or that you haven't quite seen. And it is that, yeah, it is both gothic horror and screwball comedy and kind of,
Paul and Pressburger.
Everything, you know, I've listened to a lot of podcasts about it now, you know, last night and this morning, and everyone, you know, people saying Max O'Fool, and I'm like, what you were saying earlier was like, yeah, you know, those references. I also thought Duke of Burgundy as well.
Real
kind of, just that kind of austere, tactile, you know, strangeness that's kind of very warm. And
everything's about the aesthetic, you know, in the film, of course, because it's about fashion, but he's an aesthetic as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like his whole manner and his, you know, like I say, his face and his body, and that hair at times is just swept back, so he looks really good looking. And then when he's having the bad moments, the hair sort of sticking out, it looks like this mad scientist. Do you know what I mean? It's hilarious.
Yeah. And then it is brilliant.
The voice as well. I mean, a lot. It's a sort of soft yet precise pronunciation that has it's British, but it has a hint of something foreign. You know, as well, and the phrasing of the words, and it, you know, a lot was said about his Lincoln voice and you know, his other performances, like, say, for example, in Gangs of New York, where I think that's where his kind of technical precision kind of falls over into this is me acting kind of thing, you know. But you are into the character here. I don't think you ever fall into that problem of here's Daniel Day-Lewis doing his thing, because I think that's why the women are so good. The two leads are so brilliant, and you know, Leslie Manville is perfectly cast as the sister. I mean, I just remember watching her in the Mike Leigh films, and she always struck me as that character who, I mean, not to cast dispersions on anyone I know specifically, but that sort of lower middle class woman who wants to be upper class and doesn't quite know how to do it. She always did that in Mike Leigh films. And here, she kind of does a variation on that. She has that self-contained power where she realizes what her position is in relation to Woodcock. She playing the character of Cyril, the sister, but always knows where to place herself in relation to him. And at moments when she's got to force the issue, I mean, there's that great moment where she she sort of has a go at him. And she says, I wrote it down. She says, don't pick a fight with me. You certainly won't come out alive.
Would you like me to ask Alma to leave?
No. Why?
Well, if you're going to make her a ghost, go ahead and do it, but please don't let her sit around waiting for you. I'm very fond of her.
Oh, you're very fond of her, are you? Well, in that case...
No, don't turn it on me. I don't want your cloud on my head.
Shut up, Sue.
You can shut right up. Don't pick a fight with me. You certainly won't come out alive. I'll go right through you, and it'll be you who ends up on the floor. Understood?
And Day-Lewis just kind of looks at her, and then they cut as if there is no response to that. She's in charge when she needs to be. And I think that's really clever in terms of the way that it shows the dynamics of the power relationships in ways that are much more subtle than you would normally assume when you have, like you say, the great genius, petulant man-child with all his precise needs and wants. And then Vicky Creeps as well is really beautifully cast, because I think she has this, for him, she has this grace and elegance, and the way that she's shot is, she has to be shown in an objectified way, but it's never grossly or salaciously objectified. It's kind of precisely done, because that's what he's needing her for. And there's that whole measurement scene, and then Cyril comes in. And it's really interesting how through the film, her position becomes more powerful. And at the beginning, Cyril and Alma are clearly at odds, but they work out a kind of position in relationship to each other where they complement each other in a way that puts him in that, in a sort of different dynamic in relationship to them. So it's beautifully acted, beautifully acted.
Yeah. And I think what you're kind of getting at, and we're getting that, you know, when you think about those other films like Gangs of New York or Lincoln, what we're not saying is obviously is how well written it is. You know, I mean, that screenplay and those actors are incredible, but you can see that they're clearly responding to this incredible screenplay, you know. And I think that Anderson is a great writer as well as a great filmmaker, and that is so clear in, like you say, just in the way that the story moves, and obviously the kind of the power dynamics are shifting, but not in an over the top way, in a very, very kind of subtle way. And then about the aesthetic as well, you know, like the lust and the desire, because you feel it in the film, even though it's not, you know, it's not like not salacious, but it's almost like everything's crammed into the clothes and the food, you know, like it's all there. And just these, it's incredibly tense and dynamic, because it's all, you know, sort of through the fingers of particularly his character into these clothes and these, you know, it is a remarkable piece of work, I think, that just left me kind of in awe of just how both controlled everything felt, and how planned and detailed and specific, but also how loose and emotional and enjoyable it was. It was fun, and it was clearly having fun, never without real kind of insight into relationship dynamics, both, you know, two women in that world. You know, what I loved about Manville was how, and it's interesting you sort of say about the Mike Lee, because that kind of joins a dot for me with, even in this world where he is the guy for the look at this time, you know, and he sort of hints to it that we built this house, you know, after Mother, you know, and like the thing with the mother, Manville is clinging to it. She doesn't feel like she belongs. You know, she does feel a bit like an outsider. She carries it in her face that there is a tension in terms of probably a bit of disdain, but also a bit of fear of like that we need to keep this going. You know, we're not naturalized here. We've arrived here. And I thought just so much in her performance that is just breathtaking, really. But again, I think what's interesting is I can see why people would say it's boring, or like it's a bit slow and stuff, because he relies so much on you as an audience looking at people's faces and working out what's going on. And then a moment here, you know, the way he holds a fork, you know, you're like, why is he holding that fork shot for so long? You know, like, why are we on, why is Manville looking directly at camera? why is he cutting there? You know, like there's, he's doing things and the film is doing things that is requiring you to slow down and to, you know, to kind of to engage with it. And I think that is, again, it's quite rare and, you know, it is off-putting for some audiences who not necessarily want it spoon-fed, but are used to or kind of like having more to chew on directly. And there's so much as indirect, I think, which I love. And I find that just, you know, exciting.
Yes, same here. Absolutely. I mean, and in many ways, it's a film that's about laboriousness. It's about this painstaking, obsessive practice that is required to fashion these pieces of sculpture, really, is what these dresses are, because they're sculpted, aren't they, around the body, and there's these, you know, close-up shots on the food, like you say, but also on the dressmaking itself. And I mean, and again, I think you're so right when he's playing around with this idea of the man-child genius who requires an army of women all around him to get the things done. You know what I mean? It's definitely kind of being ironic around that, but in a way, I think that like the construction of the dress and him at the center is a metaphor for, you know, the construction of the film. And there is a sort of linear process that goes on, but it's textured, it's layered. You know, there's the measuring, and then there's the cutting, and then there's the layering, and then there's the colors, and then, do you know what I mean? It reminded me of a sort of the idea of putting a film together that we like to think as this ABC linear process, but really it's almost I don't know how to describe it, but it has a temporal form, but those things are in and out. Do you know what I mean? They're backward and forward, and then when they, you know, when he sort of collapses at the moment, when, you know, when the whole sort of mushroom poisoning comes in, they have to reset the entire dress, and there's this just whole sort of process that they go through to get it together again, and like you said, the sort of the humor and the writing is just brilliant, and you know, you've said it all about that, but then there's almost sort of slapstick as well, where he has to dress this woman who obviously has got a lot of money, and clearly she's kind of doesn't, how can I put this politely, she doesn't fill out the dress in the way that he likes, and she's a bit of a louche as well, you know what I mean, sort of not particularly bright, but has got loads of money, and Manville reminds him, you've got to go to the wedding because she pays for this house, and in a sense that there's an allusion to class there, where he is the kind of, essentially he is a self-made man on the make, which is still kind of looked down on. So he's, you know, dressing like the princesses and stuff like that, but he's never in the same class as them. And Alma feels it too, that moment where she goes up to the princess and says, you know, I live here. I'm not just a seamstress or, you know, a handmaiden or whatever, you know what I mean? A helper or whatever. So there's all of that kind of class stuff riven through as well. So it is working on all sorts of levels, but it isn't allowing you just to have an easy, this is going to happen, and then the payoff is going to be like this, and then you're going to be satisfied. And even the thing that you may sort of define as the more narrative sense in terms of the development of their relationship, and then what happens in terms of this weird thing where she ends up, you know, she goes out into the woods and is collecting these mushrooms and starts poisoning him. And you, again, that could be very easily defined as a sort of narrative payoff that gives you closure on the characters, but it doesn't end up that way. It's done for more psychological reasons, and it fits into this whole, again, this whole, why do we need each other? How do relationships work in terms of their power dynamics beyond the obvious, he is the in control of things and she is his muse and has to do what he says, because that's the surface, but underneath there's so much more going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you, in that moment where it starts to kind of go, you both, it is both like exciting, you think, oh, is this, but you kind of know that it's leading somewhere, you're just not sure where, because there's that sense throughout that there's something else going on, you know, and this can't be it, you know, it can't be as simple as like you say, she's just going to poison him and that'll be it. You know, that you never feel that that's realistic. And obviously the film knows that. And so you kind of roll with it. It's just interesting hearing you sort of talk there about the kind of the metaphor of the, you know, of filmmaking. And we talk so much about, you know, we have talked, you know, about he's in conversation with kind of film history, and obviously this, you know, there's a lot written, and he's said of, as well about the relationship to Rebecca, you know, Hitchcock's Rebecca, and a lot of the kind of writing or reporting around is kind of picked up on key films. But this idea that he's kind of having fun with this, yeah, this kind of petulant man-child genius could be in conversation with his own career, you know, because I think what was so interesting about it is, like, what you're saying then is this army of people around, and you see the construction of something which one man takes credit for, which is obviously how we talk about film, you know, like, it's Paul Thomas Anderson's film, but what about these performances? What about Dylan Titchener's editing? What about Mark Bridges' incredible costume design? And what I thought was really lovely, which was one of my kind of small pleasures of the film, was how Woodcock in that space was so polite and kind of positive with his crew. You know, like, he was like, good morning, ladies, you know, this is excellent work. This is good work. And then even when the fashion show, when he kind of gets a bit shirty and he apologizes afterwards, you know, I'm sorry, you know. And I just thought that's so lovely, that kind of acknowledgement that, yes, it takes hands. You know, there's one person who has this vision and is this kind of, he's like passed out in the car. He can't possibly drive because it's been so emotional. Like, she's like, should I drive? He's like, yeah, you know, just wonderful. But there are subtle, almost say, well, yeah, you think I'm this out there renegade filmmaker, but, and that I'm happy to, for that to be the way that, you know, it's branded so that I get to make this stuff and we get to do this, but I'm never going to pretend that there isn't a construction that is collaborative. And that was one of the great things about the film, was just this place where these things are made, and it is so closed off from the world. Like, it doesn't feel like it feels like this kind of studio, you know, where it just, the outside world, people come into it, you sort of see it briefly outside, but mainly that there's very little threshold stuff. It's, you're either outside or you're inside, and inside it feels like its own universe, which I just thought was amazing.
Well, it's a very self-contained film in comparison to Inherent Vice, for example. Do you know Absolutely. What I mean? I think it's like with Inherent Vice, you just literally have no idea what's going on half the time, you know, where it's going, kind of deliberately. But in this, he's I would imagine he's sort of had in mind that he was going to make this very self-contained and very clear as to where people are in relationship to each other. And when he, you know, the trips that Alma takes into the woods and stuff are kind of very ghostly, aren't they? Sort of very, you know, like you say, it's a gothic fairy tale in many ways, but it's got such generic crossover. You can't you couldn't put it into one particular category. But yeah, you know, just I really want to see it again because I want it to sit a little bit more forcefully in my mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that what might be kind of different in terms of the kind of the clamour to go back as opposed to something like Inherent Vice is that obviously it's such a fresh area to see him working in. You know, I think that one of the things that I think that Inherent Vice suffered from was a very similar feeling maybe to Boogie Nights in terms of just on a general surface aesthetic level, and the fact that it is that period that he's so closely aligned with, you know, that kind of inspired kind of 70s Altman particularly, you know, obviously The Long Goodbye kind of hangs heavy over that film, so almost as if, well, what's the point, because that's what it's about, whereas this feels like people are gonna really want to dig in because we haven't seen him working in this area before. And, you know, like I say, it's kind of exciting, particularly with the conversations around American cinema particularly, and to have a filmmaker working in that way and kind of just going off and shooting this 1950s London fashion movie, it is exciting, you know, and not been that excited about an American film or filmmaker for a while, so it does make me want to kind of go back in and think, you know, what else is there, because it definitely feels like there's a lot there.
Brilliant. Well, really enjoyed that chat as usual.
Yeah, it's good.
What we're going to do is the Inherent Vice conversation that we had probably over a year ago now, maybe 2 years ago now, that is going to go out as a bonus episode, and we are going to have the Patreon website up and running in the next week. I know I said that ages ago, but it's, things always get shunted around, but that's definitely going to be happening very, very soon. Again, this is a test. We're gonna offer our bonus episodes now, not on the stream itself, but behind the Patreon membership account. So if you do decide to support us, we really do appreciate that. It's something that we don't know whether it will work. If it doesn't work, then we'll just knock it on the head. But it really is, I mean, it's not about, in a way, it's not about money. It's just about a little bit of support to help us do the things we do. There are expenses incurred that we don't really have any, you know, help with. I mean, occasionally we do get help when people invite us to places and that kind of thing. But there are other expenses that keep the show going. And, you know, it's not going to be expensive at all for you to support the show. Price of a coffee a week, maybe. We always say, you know, don't go into Starbucks one day, give us £2.50. You'll see it up on the Patreon website, but our bonus episodes are going to be for the Patreon subscribers only from now on.
Yeah, and along those lines, there is new merch on its way, again, as we sort of said, but that'll be with us. With you shortly, including a Paul Thomas Anderson inspired piece of merchandise. So keep your eyes peeled for that. There'll be very limited styles and runs because we want to keep it quite simple and kind of for the devotees out there who are clamoring for a bit of cinematologist merch. So both those things are incoming, along with a return to regular programming, as they say.
Indeed. So it's really good to be back. With that in mind as well, we have, like I say, the bonus episode after this one will be Inherent Vice. And then after that, I am taping at the Electric Palace. And the film is In a Lonely Place. So yeah, Nicholas Ray, Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham in the classic film noir from the 1940s. So, you know, interestingly, I want to say a change of gear, but kind of, again, you know, there are sort of elements of that sort of melodramatic relationship kind of saga in Phantom Thread, of course.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if there are any feelings evoked from by rewatching that from this. I'm sure there will be, because it's both films are very rich, kind of, you know, sort of films set in and around that kind of creative world and the kind of the mad genius and the kind of the crazy or not crazy man and the muse. So I think that'll be that'll be exciting.
Yep, so that's on February the 18th in Hastings. So if you're round and about in the southeast, then please come along. Thank you very much, Neil.
Thank you. Pleasure. Good to be back.
Good to be back. And thanks to the audience for tuning in again. Sorry it's been such a long break, but we're back now into our seventh season. And as ever, this has been the Cinematologist Podcast. Thanks for listening.